Shore Sheen Podcast, shining a light to the nations.
Shalom, everyone. This is Bill Cloud, and this is our Torah portion commentary on Matot, or translated tribes. And it's taken from the book of Numbers, Bamidbar, chapter 30, verse 1, through chapter 32, verse 42. Now, this portion begins with discussing a vow or an oath, and it establishes the sanctity of that vow or that oath. The word for vow in Hebrew is neder. Neder is nun dalet resh. A neder, a vow, is where someone can prohibit something for himself that even the Torah allows. He's, if you will, going the extra mile, so to speak. A neder can also be where that person obligates himself to do something in addition to what the Torah has stated, or something that might be optional. But it is a solemn promise, and to consecrate something to God or to do something for the Creator. Now, many times we'll see in the scriptures that vows are made in times of distress, and the motive perhaps is to secure help from heaven. For instance, in Genesis 28, verse 20 through 22, Jacob vowed a vow saying, "If God will be with me and will keep me in this way that I go, and will give me bread to eat and clothing to put on, and I come again to my father's house in peace, then shall the Lord be my God. And this stone which I have set for a pillar shall be God's house. And all that you shall give me, I will surely give the tenth to you." So he made a vow, not necessarily out of distress, but as an appeal for help from heaven. Another example of one of these vows being made in times of, if you will, distress, is in 1 Samuel chapter 1, where Hannah is desiring to have a male child. And it says, beginning in verse 9, that Hannah rose up after they had eaten in Shiloh and after they had drunk. And Eli the priest sat on the seat by the sidepost of the tabernacle of the Lord. And she was in bitterness of soul and prayed to the Lord and wept sorely. And she vowed a vow and said, "O Lord of hosts, if you will indeed look upon the affliction of your handmaid and remember me and not forget your handmaid, but will give to your handmaid a man-child, then I will give him to the Lord all the days of his life, and there shall no razor come upon his head." So these are just a couple of examples that we wanted to point out that, if you'll notice, they're made in the midst of a crisis of some sort. Jacob is in the midst of fleeing from Esau, and he's going to a foreign land. Hannah desperately wants a son. Also notice that God is the only one to hear their vow. No one else did. Jacob is alone. Hannah spoke in her heart, only moving her lips. So what this does, as far as I'm concerned, it emphasizes that once the vow is made, regardless of who hears it, it is to be performed. In other words, God expects it to be honored because it is a vow. It is a neder. Now, rabbinical sources contend that making a vow is equivalent to something that only God can do. Once a person makes a vow, he's obligated to keep that vow as if it was a commandment, as if the Creator had instructed that in the Torah. So whatever the person has vowed is bound to be kept just as strictly as God's own law. Now, sometimes we'll see that a vow is not made in a time of crisis, but is an expression of gratitude because the Creator has blessed someone or shown them favor, and so they will make a vow in response to that, just to say thank you. But as we begin the Torah portion, verse 1, it says, "And Moses spoke unto the heads of the tribes, Matot." And in verse 2, it says, "And when a man vows to the Lord or swears an oath to bind his soul with a bond." Now, we've talked about the word vow or neder. The word oath is shvua. And the root word means to be complete, to be full. In fact, the root word is the source for the word sheva or seven. But shvua implies that the one making the oath is incomplete. In other words, if the root word for shvua means to be complete or full, and that person has to make an oath, well, that again infers that they are at that point in time incomplete. And so they submit to this oath in order to be complete. The word bond is isar, and the isar is considered to be a negative oath. The word itself means to restrain, and so a self-imposed pledge to abstain from something that for others is perfectly lawful. It infers that perhaps this person finds that thing to be a potential weakness for him, while it might not be a potential weakness for others. For instance, wine is not unlawful, but wine for some might be a stumbling block. So that person realizes their deficiency and the tendency to overindulge with wine, and so they bind their soul, as the scripture says, with a bond. And they do this in order to restrain themselves from something that they realize for them might be a stumbling block, even though, again, it's perfectly lawful for someone else. So whether it's a positive vow or a negative vow, an oath, a bond, the goal is to be complete, to be everything that we're supposed to be. Now, when that person makes this vow, or he makes this oath, or binds his soul in a bond, verse 3 says, "He shall not break his word, but shall do all that proceeds from his mouth." Now, the term or the phrase "break his word" is literally profane his word, which we could say is to ignore his word, to treat it flippantly, just to say something. When the scripture talks about profaning the name of Yud-Heh-Vav-Heh, it's not talking about mispronouncing his name. It's talking about ignoring his authority or profaning his authority. So likewise, if a person vows a vow or an oath and he breaks it, he is profaning it. He's ignoring it. He is not living up to it, which goes back to something we said at the very beginning. It is understood rabbinically that when a person vows a vow, he is obligated to do it just as strictly as if he is going to keep one of the commandments that is written in the Torah. Now, when all is well, human beings have the tendency to forget what they have vowed in the midst of that crisis, but the person is still obligated to keep their word. They're supposed to follow through with everything that proceeds from their mouth, because God honors all that proceeds from his mouth. He keeps his word. So he's teaching us, when we utter a vow, when we make an oath, we too are to honor what we said. And so you can see how vows are considered equivalent as far as obedience goes, as far as fulfilling them, how they are equivalent to commands. We're certainly not saying that what we say is on the same level as what the Creator says. We're saying, though, when we make a vow, when we make an oath, we are obligated to keep it just as we would the commandment that the Creator has uttered. Now, at this point, the Torah goes on to discuss vows made by women who are under a man's authority. For instance, women who are single, that is, before marriage. And then it talks about vows that married women make. And then it discusses the vows that women after marriage make. That means widows or those who have been divorced. So in verses 3 through 5, we see that an unmarried woman who makes a vow can have it either affirmed or annulled by her father. And the criteria is, if he remains silent, then the vow will stand. But if he speaks up and he refutes that vow, then the vow is annulled. In verses 6 through 8, it addresses the vows of a married woman. Instead of the father being the one to stand up and refute it or to remain silent, in this particular case, it's the husband. And so the husband can ratify that vow that she has made, either by his silence, or he can have it annulled by standing up and refuting it. And then, of course, in verses 9 through 12, the vows pertaining to a divorced or a widowed woman. And in this case, the vows that she makes stand. Now, if she made them before she was divorced or widowed, and the husband ratified it, they are stand. And if they were made before he passed away and he annulled them, they're void. But if she makes something afterwards, when she's divorced or widowed, she, like everyone else, is committed to perform those vows. Now in verse 15, if the husband affirmed them by silence, and then he later, on down the road, recants that to annul them, he bears the guilt of those vows not being performed. So all of these commands pertaining to the vows made by women are just simply to give us some specific instructions in how each and every situation should be handled. But the point is, Once again, a vow is to be taken very seriously. An oath is to be taken very seriously. Now, as we begin in chapter 31, we have the war against Midian. And in verse 2, the Creator tells Moses to tell the children of Israel that they are to go to war against the Midianites and avenge the children of Israel of the Midianites. Of course, afterwards, Moses is going to be gathered to his fathers, but before that, he is to execute the Lord's vengeance. Because when Midian, in previous scriptures, attacked Israel, not so much on a conventional battlefield, but by sending all the daughters of Midian into the camp to seduce the men of Israel, when they attacked Israel in that way, that was equivalent to attacking the Lord. And so the men of Israel are now to execute the Lord's vengeance upon Midian. Again, the war is waged in retaliation for the role that Midian played in the incident at Baal Peor. Now, this particular war was, from what's described for us, is ruthless, and it involved all of the tribes, including Levi. And we understand that Pinchas participated in this war as well. And in a sense, Pinchas had begun what was about to escalate in this battle. Perhaps because of this war, in later years, Midian would continue to harass Israel. They would continue to be at odds. As I see it, God made sure that enmity existed between these two nations. Because Midian, again, hated Israel in such a way that they would sacrifice their own daughters, so to speak, by sending them in amongst Israel to prostitute themselves, to seduce these men into committing sins which would bring a curse upon them or which would bring destruction upon them. That's how much they hated Israel. And so this battle kind of cemented the fact that there was going to be enmity between Israel and between Midian. Now in verse 5, it says that there were 12,000, 1,000 from each tribe that went to war. And it says that in verse 6, that Pinchas went with the vessels and he went with the trumpets to sound the alarm. Apparently, he went before Israel into the battle to encourage and to exhort them to not be fearful, but to go against the enemy and to overcome them. And we read in Deuteronomy 20, verse 2, it says, "And it shall be, when you are come near unto the battle," and this is just referring to any battle, "that the priest shall approach and speak unto the people, and shall say unto them, Hear, O Israel, you approach this day unto battle against your enemies. Let not your hearts faint, fear not, and do not tremble, neither be terrified because of them. For the Lord your God is he that goes with you to fight for you against your enemies to save you." What I'm trying to point out here is that Pinchas went to do this very thing, to encourage the people not to fear their enemies, to go out and to fight them, because the Lord goes with you, and he is actually going to fight against your enemies. He's going to be the one who brings the victory in this battle. So now Pinchas goes out before the people into this battle, and he took vessels. And if the vessels Pinchas took into battle included the Ark of the Covenant, I want you to consider this. This battle resulted in a great victory for Israel because the priest and the vessels went before the people, symbolizing that the Creator was going before them into the battle, because the Ark of the Covenant, of course, is essentially his throne on earth. But here's why I bring that up. Compare this battle here and Pinchas leading them into the battle with, potentially anyway, the Ark of the Covenant. Compare this battle to the one that we read about in 1 Samuel chapter 4, which was a great defeat for Israel. And interestingly enough, there was another Pinchas at that time who took the Ark of the Covenant into battle against the Philistines. We read in 1 Samuel chapter 4, verse 4. "So the people sent to Shiloh, that they might bring from there the Ark of the Covenant of the Lord of hosts, which dwells between the cherubim. And the two sons of Eli, Hophni and Pinchas, were there with the Ark of the Covenant of God." So it's just kind of an interesting comparison. We have in this battle against the Midianites, we have a Pinchas, a priest, who is carrying the vessels and the trumpets. And again, presumably the Ark of the Covenant. He is going before them into battle to be an emblem, if you will, that the God of Israel is going before them to destroy their enemies. But then later on, we've got another Pinchas who did the same thing, but Israel was defeated, Pinchas and his brother Hophni were killed. And then, of course, the Ark of the Covenant was taken captive. So, again, just an interesting comparison. Now, in verses 7 through 8, it says that in this battle that they slew every male, including five Midianite chieftains or sheiks or kings. They also killed Balaam with the sword. That's the weapon he wanted to use. And I don't mean by physical sword, but he wanted to use words, which is likened unto a sword. He is using or desiring to use words to try to destroy them. And so Balaam was killed with the sword. And so God turns the intent of Israel's adversaries back on them. Balaam wanted to curse them. Of course, according to the Torah portion, Balak, he was not able to do that, but it's not because he didn't want to. He wanted the prestige, he wanted the honor, he wanted the money that Balak was offering him. But because of his intentions, that's why he is destroyed with the sword. Now, if they killed him there at the battle against the Midianites, obviously, when he left Balak, he had delayed his departure for Mesopotamia, I would presume, to go and claim the reward. Because when Israel fell into the sin at Baal Peor and all these people were being wiped out, he had accomplished what Balak wanted him to do, to bring a curse on them. Now consider that Balaam is from Mesopotamia, or shall we say Babylon, and he is a type of the adversary. So take note of the fact that he cannot curse Israel, but he can seduce Israel into sin. But he is ultimately destroyed with the sword, and tradition says after a trial. As we know, the adversary will ultimately be judged. The adversary will be overcome once and for all. But it's really important to see, I believe, that the adversary is not all-powerful, and therefore he cannot curse what the Creator has blessed, but he can seduce them into sin and then have them bring upon themselves what he was not capable of doing. Now, verses 9 through 14, it says that the officers of the army, that is Israel's army, took women and children captive, along with flocks and herds and other spoils of war. And this is what provokes Moses to say in Numbers 31, verses 15. Have you saved all the women alive? Behold, these caused the sons of Israel, through the counsel of Balaam, to commit sin against the Lord in the matter of Peor. And the plague was on the congregation of the Lord. And now, kill every male among the little ones, and kill every woman that is known man by lying with him. Now, you read that, that sounds pretty cruel. It just sounds pretty rigid. But it says that these caused the sons of Israel to commit this sin against the Lord. In other words, it implies that the women that he's referring to were the ones who were used to seduce Israel into sinning against God. And so they represent the evil that threatens Israel's existence. Rabbinical commentary suggests that the women were the ones who were known to have participated in this seduction. In other words, Moses is saying, these people, these women are your weakness, and they were willing to destroy you. And are you going to let them have another opportunity to destroy you? So it's better to destroy them before they destroy you. Now, again, on the surface for some, that may sound very cruel, very harsh. But let's extrapolate that just a moment. Yeshua says in Matthew chapter 5, beginning in verse 27, you have heard that it was said by them of old time, you shall not commit adultery. But I say unto you that whoever looks on a woman to lust after her has committed adultery with her already in his heart. And if your right eye offends you, pluck it out and cast it away. For it is profitable for you that one of your members should perish, and not that your whole body should be cast into hell. And if your right hand offends you, cut it off and cast it away. For it is profitable for you that one of your members should perish, and not that your whole body should be cast into hell. What I see in this particular passage, comparing it to what we just read Moses telling the children of Israel to do, where the women of Midian is concerned, is when you've got something or someone in this particular case that has already been proven, they are willing to seduce you into sin, and that sin will lead to your ultimate destruction. Then you don't abide with that or them. You would be better to destroy them or that is going to bring about your destruction rather than to try to coexist with it. Now, that is not to say that if a guy has a problem with the woman who has paid no attention to him, that he should get rid of them. That's not what we're saying. I think you understand that. But the principle would be this. When there is something, a vice, a situation, a habit, what have you, and you know that that has already proven to be a shortcoming for you, that has already proven to be a pitfall for you, and then to try to coexist with that, all you're doing is setting yourself up for destruction. I realize that in the case that we're dealing with here in the war against Midian, these women, we're talking about human lives. But Moses makes it very clear that these are the ones who were willing to destroy you. Their warfare wasn't with swords and spears and things of that nature. Their warfare was a lot more cunning than that. But the end result was intended to be the same, to destroy you. So why are you letting them live? So it's better that you destroy them before they destroy you. I hope that you understand what I'm saying here. Once again, let me be very, very clear here. I am not suggesting that people need to go out and just eradicate whatever, whoever they see as a potential pitfall for them. We're talking about, in this situation, those who had shown a willingness to destroy Israel. And we would presume, given the opportunity, they would do it again. Messiah is saying that when you got something that is a problem for you and it is potentially going to destroy you, it's better to get rid of it before it gets rid of you. And he uses the extreme examples of plucking out your eye, cutting off your right hand, those kinds of things. And we might read into that, perhaps he's just being very dramatic to make his point. But the point is, it's better to destroy that that would destroy you before it has an opportunity to do that. Once again, these women are the ones who hearkened under the counsel of Balaam, who again is that type of adversary. Now those females who were virgin and who were not part of the sin, these women were made domestic servants. They were allowed to live. So there is a distinction here between the women, those who were willing to destroy Israel and those who play no participation in that war, if I can use that word. Now, once again, to our culture, this kind of solution to their problem would appear to be cruel. But once again, remember, a cancer that is left to spread will do that, and it will eventually kill the entire body. And so Moses, if you will, is telling them to eradicate the cancer, because if we don't do this, the whole body is going to perish. We need to keep in mind that we weren't there when all this was going on, and it's impossible for us to accurately judge this situation. We're looking at it from a distance. And so I think it's really important that we keep in mind that we're looking at this 3,500 years later. And so to just pass judgment and say, well, that was very cruel what they did, I think that's unfair. And it's overlooking the fact that the folks that were eradicated here were themselves willing to destroy Israel. We might also want to keep in mind that if anyone's going to be sensitive to this situation, it would have been Moses, because Midian was, through marriage anyway, Moses' physical kinsman. So again, if anyone was going to be sensitive to the fact that we're going to have to get rid of these people, it seems to me it would have been Moses, because they were related to him through marriage. Now in verses 19 through 24, as a result of this battle, everything and everybody that came in contact with Midian must be cleansed. Those who touched a corpse, they have to be cleansed along with their captives. They had to be outside the camp, which is to say, really, the tabernacle courtyard. In other words, they weren't forbidden to come in contact with the congregation necessarily, but they were forbidden to come in contact with the tabernacle and the courtyard and everything that pertained to that that was holy, because they committed warfare. There was blood. There were dead bodies. There were unclean things. And so they had to be cleansed along with their captives. The spoil, including the vessels that they took, had to be purified by fire and or waters of purification. The vessels, of course, had to be purged of any unclean food that might have been placed in them. And after purging, they had to be purified. Now, something that jumped out at me here is, seeing that we are earthen vessels, The purging of the unclean precedes the purifying. The purifying, not the purging, allows us to approach the Creator. And of course, we're talking about ultimately through Yeshua. So again, the purging has to remove all of those unclean things, and then comes the purifying. And it's the purifying that allows us to approach Him. And of course, Yeshua the Messiah, once again, is the one who has accomplished this for you and I. Now, verses 25 through 54, it gives us the details of the sum of the prey that was taken. And we're certainly not going to go item by item here, but what we're going to do is just a couple of highlights here. In verse 32, we're given the sum of the livestock that Israel took. And what that does is it suggests by the number of livestock that Israel conquered a very prosperous nation. And verse 40, we see that 16,000 people were taken captive. And in verse 52, it indicates that an incredible amount of gold was taken as spoil. So Israel went to war with a very powerful, apparently, and very prosperous nation. But because the Lord was with them, they conquered this very prosperous nation. And in verse 49, we see that the victory was so complete that not one man of Israel was missing after this battle, not one casualty at all, indicating that when God advises Israel to go to war, there should be no fear of enemy. When God advises us to do anything, there should be no fear of our enemies. And it also indicates that Midian would have been better off had they stayed out of Balaam's plot. Because the adversary, Balaam's a type of the adversary is going to use people again, and they fall victim to this idea that somehow, some way, they can harass Israel, defeat Israel, and there be no repercussions. But Midian should have stayed out of Balaam's plan. But because they didn't, they were defeated soundly, and Israel took great spoil from them. Now, as we move on into chapter 32, we see that there are tribes that are going to remain on the east side of Jordan. They're preparing to come into the land. And as this is getting ready to happen after this great battle, Reuben and Gad request to remain on the eastern bank of the Jordan. Now, it's presumed that had this request not been ultimately granted, that the east bank of the Jordan would have been jointly owned by all of the tribes. But anyway, this area that we're talking about was eventually given to the tribe of Reuben, to the tribe of Gad, and the half-tribe of Manasseh, and specifically the families of Machir and Gilead. Later on, the area became known as Gilead, and this area was covered with forests, orchards, vineyards. It produced perfumes and medicines for the ancient world, the Balm of Gilead. It was also later going to be the home to the prophet Elijah, who was the Gileadite. Now, because of the request, Moses asks this question in Numbers 32, verses 6 and 7. He says, "Shall your brothers go to war, and shall you sit here? And why do you break the heart of the sons of Israel from going over into the land which the Lord has given them?" Basically, he's asking them, what gives you the right to be exempted from the war of conquest? Furthermore, if I let you stay over here, you'll prompt the other tribes to want to stay on this side of the Jordan as well. And so what we'll have is a repeat of what happened when the 10 spies gave their evil report. Keep in mind that those that Moses is speaking to now, at this time, had not been born when the 10 spies gave their evil report, or had been very, very young. And so he is reminding them of what happened as a result of that evil report, in that the people didn't want to go into the land, they were afraid, and they wanted to stay out of the land. And so Moses is making it very clear, if I let you do this, you're going to be, in effect, doing the same thing to Israel that those 10 spies did. Now, in verse 12, he reminds the people, in conjunction with this argument, that Caleb and Joshua were the only ones of that generation who were going to enter the land. So, in other words, do you want the same thing to happen to you that happened to that generation before you? Caleb and Joshua were the only ones prepared to enter the land of Canaan, and that would be the emphasis. So he's posing all these questions to them and really warning them of what they're potentially doing here. So in verses 16 through 19, we see that these tribes responded to Moses with a promise, if you will, a vow, an oath. They said, "Allow us to build pens for our livestock, to repair and fortify the cities for our families on this side of the Jordan, and then we will go at the head of the column. We'll go out in the front to fight the war until all of Israel is settled." And what that really meant was that they were committing themselves for a period of 7 years, because the war of conquest, is my understanding anyway, lasted for 7 years. So after they made this oath, Moses responds favorably to their request, but he reminds them of the vow that they have made. And remember, if you make a vow, it's as important to keep that vow as it is the commandments that God has instructed you. You are to honor your word. So he reminds them of the vow that they have made. And considering what we learned at the beginning of this Torah portion, it's a sacred vow, and it must be honored just as surely as you honor God's commands. Now, he did not require them to necessarily remain after the war was won. But verse 22 makes it clear that they must be clear before the Lord and before Israel. In other words, not only must their conscience be clear before God, but their actions, their deeds must be above reproach so that Israel can see that too. They must avoid things that appear to be wrong. And so this is, to me, a very important thing. When he tells them that you have to be clear before the Lord and before Israel or before your countrymen, avoid the very appearance of going back on your word, or avoid the very appearance of doing wrong. Or as Paul puts it in 1 Thessalonians, abstain from every appearance of evil. See, God knows what's in our hearts, and we can do things on the outside, but we can't hide from God those things that are internal, that we can't hide from Him the intent of our heart. However, we can hide that from our brethren. So Moses is saying, not only obey and honor your word in your heart, but do it in your actions so that everybody who sees you will know that you're doing the right thing. If they had not, Moses warned them, if they didn't keep their word, he said, your sin will find you. Now, rabbinical commentary considers that, like a curse, sin has an individual existence. The sinner, in other words, cannot escape its consequence. The sin is going to track you down, it's going to find you, and it's going to overtake you as if it were an existing entity. But the only thing that can stop this is repentance, and of course, the atonement of the Messiah. So I think that's very interesting. He said, your sin will find you. It'll hunt you down, and it will overtake you. And so, considering that all of us have sinned, we've all fallen short, we've all committed errors, if our sins have the potential of tracking us down and overtaking us, then that accentuates the need for repentance. That accentuates the benefit of the atonement of the Messiah, and should accentuate the need for us to be thankful every day that His mercies are new every morning. Now, later in Scripture, we do see that they did indeed keep their vow, because we read in Joshua chapter 22, beginning at verse 1, then Joshua called for the Reubenites and the Gadites and the half-tribe of Manasseh and said to them, you have done all that which Moses, the servant of the Lord, commanded you, and you have listened to my voice and to all that I have commanded you. You have not left your brothers these many days until today and have kept the observance of the command of the Lord your God. They did indeed keep their vow. Now, this whole sequence of events, and specifically the tribe of Gad and Reuben asking to stay on the other side, prompting Moses to say, are you going to just sit out the war and let your brethren fight the war for you? Prompts this question for me. If we are Israel in Messiah, at what point do we go to war for the sake of the land and for our brethren? It would seem to me that we must also be willing to deny ourselves at some point for His sake and for His purposes. I'm not saying that's necessarily in my lifetime or yours, but the question still remains. If we are Israel, how long are we going to allow our brethren to fight the war for the land? And at what point are we going to be called upon to do so? Just something for you to consider. In verse 33, it says that Moses gave the land of Sion and Og to Reuben, to Gad, and to the half-tribe of Manasseh. Now, to me, it's interesting that Joseph's descendants were among those who settled on the east of the river. Now, it says half-tribe, but that's not really accurate. It would only really be part of the tribe of Manasseh, and specifically the families of Machir and Gilead, because you won't find anywhere where these families requested to live on the east bank. And so it's believed that Moses placed them there, knowing that these families would help create an environment where there would be a close contact between those who were on the east bank of the Jordan and those who were on the western bank of the Jordan. And if Joseph's sons, Machir and Gilead, were there, then that would have collateral effect on Reuben and Gad. And so it would just kind of keep the family together, keep the country united. Verse 39 makes a point of emphasizing the children of Machir, because they dispossessed the Amorites there and they dwelt in that land. And again, that's interesting because this is the land where Elijah is going to one day dwell. Manasseh, of course, was the one who represented forgetfulness of where I came from. And Elijah, who was going to live in this place where the children of Machir, who is of Manasseh, remember, Elijah is going to come in his day and he's going to call the children of Israel to remember who we are. So as we close this Torah portion, that seemed to be the best point to make. A lot of these things that we've talked about, it's about the tendencies among human beings to forget. You make a vow in the midst of a crisis, and then the crisis passes, and you forget. But Elijah represents one who is to call us to remember the vow we've made, to remember the commitment we've made, and to remember who we are. And when we remember who we are, then we realize there is an obligation to not only keep our vows, our oaths, but to keep the commandments of our Creator. So with that, we come to the end of this Torah portion. Shalom.
Like what you're hearing? Become a BillCloud Premium Partner to watch or listen to hundreds of hours of teachings and resources on demand. Go to BillCloud.com/subscribe to start watching today.